The matter of Ellen Baskin versus PC Richard & Son, LLC. May we please have appearances of counsel.
Good morning and happy new year. Shant Yadalian on behalf of the plaintiff and appellant Ellen Baskin.
Good morning, justices, and happy new year to all. Bruce Nagel, Nagel Rice, amicus for NJAJ.
Good morning, your honors. Happy new year. Bill Gives of Kelly Dry and Warren for PC Richard & Son, LLC and PC Richard & Son, Inc.
Welcome, counsel. Happy new year. We're pleased to have you. Mr. Medallion, you may proceed.
Thanks, your honor. May it please the court. Before I begin, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
We'll have you back, perhaps for a little less. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Both the law division and the appellate division, in a published opinion, rang the death knell for class actions in this state. They did so by imposing three different barriers to class certification at the pleading stage. Each of these barriers on its own has the effect of precluding class actions in this state. I'm going to walk through each of the three barriers, why they're inappropriate, and how they preclude class actions. The first barrier concerns numerosity. In the complaint, we conservatively, but expressly pled that, quote, there are at a minimum thousands, i.e. 2,000 or more members that comprise the class, end quote. Under well-established class certification principles, this allegation was required to be accepted as true. The appellate division acknowledged in its opinion that a class size of 40 or more satisfies numerosity, but held that we failed to specify the number of class members. Before the appellate division's published opinion, there was no authority, state or federal, that we're aware of, that requires pleading with specificity the number of class members at the pleading stage. And it's not difficult to understand why such a requirement does not and should not exist. In all of the class actions that I've been involved in, not once have I run across a situation where pre-discovery and at the pleading stage, I've had information concerning the exact size of the class, nor have I seen any other cases where someone else has been able to plead such in a complaint without discovery. The closest I've come across is when I was representing insurance adjuster employees against their employer insurance company in an employment class action. Even there, where the class members were employees, they still were not privy to the total number of employees employed by their employer over the course of several years. In contrast, this case does not involve employee class members. It involves consumer class members, customers who cannot possibly know the exact number of total customers at the pleading stage and without any discovery. The appellate division specificity requirement concerning the number of class members will make it impossible for almost all, if not all, class actions to move beyond the pleading stage. As such, this barrier alone sounds the death knell for class actions in this state. I'd like to add that not even the defense contested numerosity. This barrier was imposed sua sponte by both of the lower courts. Also, this isn't a situation where either the defense or the lower courts claimed that our allegations are implausible. Not that we need it anymore, but our complaint isn't even light on the facts. In the complaint, the class is defined to have a start date of November 18, 2013. Moreover, the complaint alleges that on November 2, 2015, we served defendants with a notice to cease and desist the FACTA violations, but the defendants continued the FACTA violations until August 17, 2016, a period of 9.5 months after being served with a cease and desist letter. Thus, as pled in the complaint, the class period spans for at least 2 years and 9 months. In addition, the record shows that more than 25% of the defendant's stores, 17 of their stores, are located in New Jersey. If each of their 17 New Jersey stores provided a receipt to only one customer per day, in 3 days, there would already be 51 class members. And again, we pled a class period of not just 3 days, but at least 2 years and 9 months. Thus, we more than adequately pled numerosity and the dismissal of the class allegations with prejudice and without leave to amend was error and must be reversed to prevent the death knell of this and other class actions in this state. The second barrier imposed by the lower courts concerns predominance as to damages. The complaint pleads that statutory damages are sought. There is no claim for actual damages. Statutory damages are recoverable under FACTA if we can show that defendant's conduct was willful. Willfulness under applicable Supreme Court authority includes reckless conduct. Willfulness depends solely on the defendant's conduct. Defendants either acted willfully or they didn't. If defendants acted willfully, then statutory damages are uniformly available across the board to all class members. Thus, this is an ideal example of a case for class treatment. If a case like this where statutory damages are involved can't be certified, then no case can be certified. A lower court's claim that this case involves varying damage determinations is contrary to the allegations of the complaint and contrary to how statutory damages function. In fact, so much so that not even the defense contested predominance. It was imposed sua sponte by the lower courts. If the lower court's holding applies to end the class in a case like this, then it'll end all other class actions. That's simply not the law. This court has repeatedly held that even in cases where actual damages are at issue and require individual damage determinations, such does not defeat predominance where there are common issues as to liability. This court's cases include Iliadis versus Walmart stores, listing how much damages employees suffered, if any, as among the individual issues, but still reversing the lower court's denial of certification. In Re Cadillac, recognizing that damages and other things were individualized, but certifying a class despite that. And Strawn v. Canuso, where despite potential issues of causation, reliance, and damages particular to the individual actions, there was predominance and a class was certified. In each of those cases, this court certified classes despite individualized damages. The appellate division's published opinion conflicts with this court's authority and would have the effect of ending class actions in this state. It's erroneous and must be reversed. The third barrier imposed by the lower courts concerns a broad proposition about superiority. That broad proposition is that if you have a statutory cause of action that provides for the recovery of statutory damages, that type of claim can never proceed as a class action. According to the defense in the lower courts, because statutory damages are recoverable in small claims court, a class action can't be a superior method of enforcement. For this broad proposition, the defense and the lower courts relied on the local baking opinion. However, local baking isn't at all that broad. In fact, near the beginning of the local baking opinion, the panel explains that it is dealing with a, quote, narrow issue, end quote. That narrow issue concerned a single page junk fax and the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, the TCPA. As local baking explains, the TCPA in its earlier bill form did not have a private remedy. Instead, the only enforcement power was given to the FCC and the Attorney General. The local baking opinion goes on to explain that it was only as a result of a late amendment, by Senator Hollings, who was the sponsor of the TCPA, that a private remedy was added, but done with the purpose of allowing a consumer to go to small claims court without an attorney to seek statutory damages. Local baking goes on to illustrate the process and explains that the plaintiff files a complaint, shows up with the junk fax, and recovers the $500 and done. Obviously, if the legislative history of a statute confirms that Congress adopted a remedies provision to be enforced only in small claims court, then no one has any business talking about a class action and that a class action should proceed anywhere. That type of legislative history is a far cry from other statutory causes of action, such as FACTA. Unlike the TCPA, FACTA has no such legislative history showing that Congress intended that it should be enforced only in small claims court. This difference alone establishes that local baking's holding is inapposite to FACTA. Thus, if local baking were good law and correctly interpreted the legislative history of the TCPA, it would still be a narrow holding that would not apply to FACTA. However, local baking isn't even good law. Local baking was decided in 2011. The following year, in 2012, the US Supreme Court decided a case called Mims versus Aero Financial Services LLC, 565 US 368. In MIMS, the same arguments about legislative history and small claims court about the TCPA were made, but the Supreme Court rejected that interpretation of the statute and rejected that interpretation of the legislative history and held that TCPA claims are not limited to small claims court and may proceed in state and federal district courts. And obviously in federal court, there is no such thing as federal small claims court. There are other features of FACTA that further highlight its differences with the TCPA. Unlike the TCPA, where you just show a junk fax and get paid, FACTA only allows for statutory damages if a willful violation is established. As someone who's handled FACTA cases for many years, I know how much attorney work, including discovery, goes into trying to establish a willful violation. A small claims court isn't equipped for that. Congress also knew this, and therefore to encourage attorneys to prosecute FACTA claims and enable consumers to be able to get an attorney to prosecute, provided for the recovery of attorney's fees. The TCPA doesn't have a fees provision. The other FACTA remedies also show how a FACTA claim is incompatible with small claims court. If you add the statutory damages, punitive damages, and attorney's fees under FACTA, the total exceeds the $3,000 limit of small claims court. Consumers can't be forced to proceed in small claims court and waive recovery in excess of $3,000. In contrast, the TCPA recovery is below $3,000 and therefore is different and not an issue. The defense responds that for discovery purposes, for remedies purposes, send plaintiffs' FACTA claim to the law division instead of small claims court. But that comment only further highlights the differences between FACTA and the TCPA. Moreover, superiority is a comparative principle, and the law division compared a class action with small claims court. If you're going to compare a class action to an individual action in the law division, then a new analysis in the first instance is required, and the law division did not do that in assessing superiority. All of these differences show that local banking and the TCPA are in a positive and different. Respectfully, this court must reverse the appellate division's published opinion. Otherwise, it renders the death of class actions in this state. And I say that not just as an attorney in this case or just as a consumer protection attorney. I say that as a concerned citizen.
Counsel, if you've completed your opening statement, if in fact you are correct that Congress's intent was that in federal court the FACTA cases proceed and should proceed in a class action, how do you explain the standing cases, including the standing case Kamal out of the Third Circuit, that says that in the absence of actual injury, there is no Article III standing in those cases? That seems to contravene what you characterize to be congressional intent.
So there are, and Kamal is just one case. There are plenty of other cases concerning standing, and they cut both ways. For example—
And one of them was in your very case, right? Your case was thrown out in the Southern District on standing.
Well, that's right, by the district court. But I also have, for example, in the DC circuit, we had a FACTA case where the DC circuit found that there is standing in that FACTA case. And the defense sought a petition for en banc review. The DC circuit denied it. It became final. So there's an example of where Article III standing has been satisfied. So there is this split of authority as to Article III. But Article III is a barrier to federal courts with respect to Article III itself. So let me back up for a second. So Article I of the Constitution empowers Congress to legislate. Article III places limits on a federal court's ability to hear cases that involve concrete injuries. Now, if Congress legislates and says that we're passing this law, it doesn't mean that if a federal court can't hear it, it becomes a statute that can't be enforced. I just had an appeal just a few weeks ago. We got the result before the Ninth Circuit, where I filed a case in state court. It was a FACTA case. The defense removed it to federal court, claiming that there's Article III jurisdiction. And we argued that even if there isn't Article III, if there is Article III jurisdiction, because we filed it in state courts, it's the defense's obligation to prove, since they're the one
who moved. Why is Article III relevant?
It's not.
Article III is specific to the United States Constitution. We don't even have a similar provision in the New Jersey Constitution. So why would it be relevant to a New Jersey court's consideration?
It, exactly, Your Honor, and it's not. Congress has the ability to legislate, and they legislated, and that's the statute can be enforced in state court. And Article III does not apply.
Legislation doesn't require injury. That's the whole willful part of it. If we were to use some sort of standing issue, there would be no way of even enforcing that part of the statute. But let me the question I want to ask you is about small claims court, because you were talking about your concern exceeding the jurisdictional limits. Now, I thought you would be making the other argument that there is so little money that might be in controversy because it's between 100 and 1,000. The statutory damage may be just $100. Like who is going to go to small claims court? Let's say, forget about getting an attorney, an individual going to figure out how to file it, go to court to file it, go to small claims, maybe not even be heard the same day, take off time, consume hundreds of dollars of their time to try to get $100 or $500. Like, who would do that on a cost benefit basis? And I'm raising that because this is one of the arguments for a class action being superior, but go ahead.
That's absolutely true. And we echoed those same concerns with respect to the comparative principles in addressing superiority. And in fact, this case has been going on for years. There hasn't been a single consumer that has stepped forward and filed a case in small claims court. And that's a fact.
Because there aren't that many of them, counsel? You're suggesting that's because they don't want to file small claims court. It could also be that perhaps there are not as many as you think.
Well, we pled that there are
argument of numerosity.
Well, yes, and we've pled that there are thousands of class members in that.
You said there could be. Your complaint said there could be.
If you look,
they said there are.
Well, we didn't say there could be. The court said there could be. We said that there are in the complaint. That's the specific allegation. And it says not only that there are thousands, but that there are at a minimum thousands.
But is that really that surprising? Because you have here, your client, as I understand it, your New Jersey client, has had no identity theft, has had no actual injury as a result of this number being on the receipt. Is it really that surprising that no one has decided to litigate a number, four digits of a number being on a receipt when they have not suffered any harm, even, you know, arguable harm?
Well, I
mean, is that really the test we should look for, whether people are suing in small claims, when we're talking about here, by definition, people who got a receipt at PC Richard, presumably either threw it away or didn't, it had numbers on it, and nothing ever came of that?
Well, that illustrates Justice Albin's point exactly, is that the damages are either very small or non-existent, but that statutory damages are recoverable. And given the low amount of damages and the time and expense required to try to recover them, the superiority element is satisfied because, as Justice Albin pointed out, few, if any, consumers are going to go to small claims court to seek such a remedy.
If Congress would not have enacted this particular piece of legislation unless they wanted it enforced, they certainly, I would think, not have created a piece of remedial legislation and therefore made it almost impossible to have it enforced in some sort of court. Because no attorney that I know of, or few attorneys, are going to undertake a small claims case for $100, $500 and expend $5,000, $10,000 in order to get a recovery for a single client. Am I mistaken about that?
No, you're not. And the U.S. Supreme Court has reflected that principle time and time again. For example, in deposit guarantee, they said that it's unrealistic to expect any attorney to undertake representation in a case.
Is that generally the cost of prosecuting a small claims case, about $10,000? Is that generally what it costs you to prosecute a small claims case?
I'm located in California, and in California, we can't even get attorney representation in small claims court.
Is that what it costs in California, $10,000? Is that what it costs in New Jersey to proceed in small claims court, about $10,000?
To proceed in small claims court? Figure the amount of attorney hourly time. My hourly rate is $650. You can imagine that those hours add up pretty quickly.
How many hours do you think it takes to file a small claims complaint, appear in court, and prove your case without a jury, without jury selection, without openings, and then receive your result? How long do you think that takes?
Well, willfulness is an issue, and we're hamstrung in small claims court because we can't conduct discovery. I mean, if you go,
you're entitled to interrogatories in small claims court.
Okay. It's going to be in excess of $10,000. That's for sure. I mean, I don't know. I can't answer that. I can tell you that in other FACTA cases, I've done a lot of FACTA cases, litigation can go on for years and years and years, and you have issues with discovery, law in motion concerning discovery. Each case is different.
Are attorney's fees available to a prevailing party on a statutory claim under FACTA in small claims court in New Jersey?
Yes.
And, you know, obviously, there may be states, you say California, you know your California law where an attorney is not available, but in New Jersey, an attorney can litigate that case and get paid, correct?
That's right. Well, except subject to the $3,000 cap, inclusive of all the other remedies.
That the question is not whether there's an alternative to class action, but whether or not the alternative is superior to the class action. And your contention, the theme of your argument is that allowing a small claims action to proceed with or without counsel is not superior to the class action vehicle that your action is offering. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. And the rule requires an analysis into whether it's realistic to expect other consumers to proceed with individual actions. And the fact of the matter is, we can look back. We have the benefit of retrospect here. We can look back. This case has been going on for years, and there are no other individual actions that have been filed or are pending. And that demonstrates.
Is it even fair, counsel, to be comparing as some of the analysis of the appellate division decision seems to suggest, an inactive class member with an individual claim brought in small claims prosecuted by an attorney? Are they even comparable? Doesn't the inactive class member do much better through the class action vehicle?
Well, I think they're yes, because they don't have to go out, spend the time, try to get an attorney. They're probably going to be unsuccessful, as Justice Alvin pointed out, in trying to seek counsel that would agree to represent them in small claims court. I think it's unrealistic to have that expectation. It hasn't happened, and there's a reason for that. I mean, I can tell you personally, if I was confronted by a client who said, represent me in small claims court, I'm not going to spend my time doing that. It's just, from a business perspective, it just doesn't make any sense.
And on the issue of liability, isn't the class action vehicle much superior to individual claims that could be discordant, inconsistent in small claims? Whereas the commonality of the liability question on willfulness is better for everyone to be litigated in one shot, is it not?
That's absolutely correct, including for the defense for res judicata purposes. Because if you continue to have individual actions, which can number in, you know, potentially the thousands or more, then you have to consider that in assessing superiority, because the efficiencies that are involved, including the burden on the court system, I mean, it's not efficient to, as PC Richards suggests, argues to have different courts bogged down with multiple actions. I mean, for example, in this case, our two other plaintiffs, their position was have them go to New York and litigate in New York. They can say the same for, you know, in all of the other states that they operate in and all of the other counties and districts that they operate in, and tell those particular individuals to go out and litigate. That is a burden on the court system, and potentially, as you pointed out, can result in incompatible determinations by the court. For example, what you're alluding to is that you can have one court find liability, another court find that there is no liability. Also, discovery would have to be repeated over and over again as to those individual cases.
I gather from the nature of your pleadings that you expect to attempt to prove willfulness by the repetitive nature of not correcting machines that are issuing receipts with allegedly improper amount of information from credit cards contained on them, correct? Over and over.
We can do discovery. And for example, take the depositions of the defendant's employees, for example. If there are third parties involved, and frequently there are, like card processors, et cetera, we can take a subpoena, issue subpoenas, and take those depositions, do other discovery. Now, if another individual comes along and you're going to split the cases and into individual cases, then they're not going to have the benefit of our discovery. They're going to have to do a rerun and do that same discovery.
Or an attorney like you, and this goes to superiority, an attorney like you will collect 100 plaintiffs, bring 100 plaintiffs down to small claims court, and try one after another. And that certainly isn't going to satisfy the manageability piece of this from the court perspective, and certainly isn't going to be superior to joining all of these cases in one action.
That's absolutely right. And we can do that over and over and over again until we get a liability determination that goes against the defendant. So if we lose the first time, we're not out. But that cuts against the principle of res judicata, the efficiencies that are involved in proceeding with a class action. We do it once and done. Either PC Richards, there is liability against it, or there isn't.
Can you please clarify an answer you gave earlier? Are attorney's fees counted toward the $3,000 cap in small claims court?
Yes.
What's the authority you rely on for that principle?
There is no, the small claims court authorizes attorneys in the state of New Jersey, but caps all remedies as to $3,000. And so whether it's statutory damages, whether it's punitive damages, whether it's attorney's fees, all that is inclusive in the $3,000. And that's a point, by the way, that PC Richards does not dispute. And instead they say, well, if it exceeds $3,000, just send it to the law division instead of forcing the plaintiffs to waive their right to recover over $3,000.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add at this point?
Not at this point. Thanks, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Nagel. Please unmute yourself.
That helps. Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. The issue before the court today is whether this court will choose to reverse two longstanding rules of law. The first rule of law was established approximately 50 years ago in Riley versus New Rapids Carpet, where this court set forth the very clear standard that the class action rule shall be liberally applied in order to support the strong public policy of consumer protective actions. And in the body of the opinion, made it clear in quote, class actions should lie unless clearly infeasible. And that's at 225 of the opinion. And that's been a rule of law that's been followed for 50 years until this case came down. The second rule of law that intersects with the first rule of law was established approximately 30 years ago in Printing Mart versus Sharp Electric, And that case established the rule that in assessing a motion to dismiss on the pleadings, the court is required to do a meticulous, in-depth search of the pleadings to glean even a suggested cause of action. And if a suggested cause of action cannot be found, leave to amend should be liberally granted. So we have two intersecting rules of laws that have been ignored by the court below, have not been addressed properly by the court below. And if this case is affirmed, we fully agree with Mr. Yeladian, this will effectively end class action law in New Jersey and shut the courthouse to millions of our residents and out-of-state individuals who have claims here in New Jersey.
Let me ask you, Mr. Nagel, about your second point, because the printing mark, this is a little bit unusual. Perhaps unusual is the wrong word, but this is a situation where the substantive allegations were not really the issue. It was the class allegations that were the issue. So obviously the printing mark status is someone alleges the elements of negligence or whatever it may be. Under printing mark, you assume those to be true and you judge whether there is a cause of action pled. Here we have the class allegations at issue. Is it improper for a court to essentially do a class certification analysis on a motion to dismiss under Rule 4.6?
No, it's not, Justice Patterson. And I also respectfully disagree with your reading or application of printing mark insofar as the numerosity issue is concerned. So let me address that if I can.
Leave aside numerosity for the moment, if you don't mind. I just want to understand what should a trial court do when faced with a motion to dismiss in which there are assertions by the defendant that this class is not certifiable.
The court under printing mark is obligated to accept the pled allegations as truthful. And where the pleading itself suggests that the four requirements of the class cert rule 4:32-1 have been met, that is sufficient to defeat a motion to dismiss.
And the reason I raise this is because there have been a number of cases where courts have adjudicated class certification issues at the pleading stage. Are you saying that all the plaintiff's counsel needs to do is say, we meet the four requirements of Rule 432, say a sentence on each of them, we meet them as a conclusory, not a factual allegation, but we meet them. We have numerosity. We have and go through the requirements, and then at that point the court can do nothing, because there has been an allegation that the class certification rule is met. Is that your position?
I wouldn't exactly say yes without a qualification. What I would tell you is this: I do not agree with the framing of the issue, conclusory allegations. I believe the plaintiff has a minimum obligation to set forth certain facts which support the conclusion. I certainly agree with that, which was done in this complaint. And remarkably, not even mentioned by the appellate division.
Okay, numerosity is a factual issue. And I see where what you're saying with numerosity makes a lot of sense.
And I can walk through the others.
Let's talk about superiority, because superiority is not a matter of just asserting facts. Is it enough for the plaintiff's lawyer to say the class action device is superior to any alternatives?
The answer to that is yes, it is sufficient under printing mark. And the reason why it's sufficient, because after full discovery and after experts will give their opinions as to the way in which the trial plans will be litigated, the court will make a reasoned decision on a record, as they would do in a summary judgment down the road. So the answer to that is yes.
If I may, under your interpretation of printing mark, can any class action ever be dismissed on any grounds? Printing mark says it's the complete liberality to search for any probable cause of action without looking towards the outcome. So is based on your interpretation of that language, is your position that no class action can ever be defeated at the motion to dismiss stage?
What I will answer respectfully is virtually none. There may be some circumstance that I intellectually am not focusing on today during the argument that may qualify. But from my position,
see how, based on your understanding of your
and having litigated class actions and argued actually three or four already before this Supreme Court, it is my view that a proper pleading sustains a motion to dismiss, and that the law of New Jersey should not be, we should not have a standard.
But I don't want to know about those should be. Under your interpretation, I guess I'm correct. No class action should ever be dismissed on a motion to dismiss.
Again, there may be an intellectual issue that I haven't focused on, but my strong feeling is under printing mark, if you properly plead the elements, it should not be dismissed on a motion. That's correct, Justice.
So that means any class action has to go through what you know from your long experience is in a class action for just realistically years of discovery before and it may ultimately be sustained or it may ultimately be dismissed, but there is no escape valve for a defendant sued in a class action, assuming that the plaintiff just writes down that the standards are met. There's nothing that can get the case resolved prior to all of that discovery.
That's not correct, Justice Patterson. As the court is well aware, the way in which these cases proceed is virtually every court, in effect, bifurcates issues. So there is an initial phase where we focus on the class certification issue in every phase. So that is always litigated before the ultimate issue.
Can I ask why are we have a case before us? Like, why are we dealing with unknown scenarios? Looking at this particular case in printing more in 462, does it pass the test on numerosity, superiority, and predominance? And what are the reasons? Instead of talking about cases that aren't before us, why don't you talk about a case that is before us?
I'm happy to do so, Justice Albin. I apologize. I thought I was directly answering the inquiries of Justice Patterson. I didn't mean to get sidetracked, but I will focus. In this case, there was sufficient pleading to defeat the motion under printing mark. And what's bothersome to us as amicus is that there was no mention at all in either the trial court opinion or the appellate division opinion of printing mark. There was no analysis of the printing mark sufficiencies or no analysis of the 462 standards. So in effect, you have a case that's was dismissed on the pleadings without even applying the applicable law. Whether or not you disagree with the law or want to carve an exception out, there was no analysis at all. Printing mark was not applied to this case, and that's just wrong. Now, again, I don't think I need to walk down all the hypotheticals. As you pointed out, I'd like to focus on why.
Before you focus, counsel, am I wrong that this court focuses on issues beyond the case before it, that we rule it to issues in the future and make decisions on our opinions that affect the facts in the future? We're not a trial court. We don't just rule in the case before us. Am I wrong about that?
Well, of course not. The reason why we're here is because we're trying to preserve class action litigation, and we're trying to leave printing mark as a standard that applies in New Jersey as it has for the last 30 years. And if this case is affirmed, both of those rules of law, in our view, will be thrown out the window. And I don't mean to use that pejoratively, but that's the effect of affirming this case.
Is printing mark, Mr. Nagel, printing mark's about factual allegations, correct? I mean, you would never say on it, let's just say a negligence case, you would never say, I say that he was negligent, therefore assume he was negligent. It's about factual allegations, is it not? Court assumes the truth of the allegations in the complaint.
Justice Patterson, there are areas in the law where you can't plead facts. There's overlaps between facts and legal issues, and there's conclusions that you have to plead. All of those are dealt with in printing mart, and printing mart has told us for 30 years, you leave those cases alive. And in the context of a class action, what I've said, and it's worth repeating, in the context of class action, there already is the safety valve that you're concerned with. There's the initial focus on the class certification issue,
I see on numerosity, there's a factual allegation, okay? And you would argue, and you are arguing, and as your colleague is arguing, that the court should have assumed the truth of the factual allegation with respect to the number of claimants. But what I'm frankly having concerns with is that the other aspects of the class action are not factual. Predominance, superiority, the two that are at the core of this, predominance and superiority are not factual allegations. And what you are saying to us, which is where I am running to trouble with your argument, is that as soon as a plaintiff's counsel says that there's predominance under Rule 432 or superiority under B1, that's all that you need under Printing Mart. And I think that, tell me why I'm wrong. I think that's the equivalent of saying, I'm sure you will.
I will.
I think that's the equivalent of saying, as long as there's an allegation of negligence or an allegation of liability under a statute, whatever it may be, that's the ball game under Printing Mart. That I don't think is the case.
Okay. So let's take superiority in the context of this case. Okay. So, in my view, the pleading could simply say this is a superior method to litigating than litigating over 2,000 cases in small claims court. That's sufficient. Quite frankly, it's sufficient to say it's a superior method to any other. That's sufficient. Now, if that's not
sufficient. That's it. There's no.
That's all you need. Now, if that's not sufficient for this court, then there's leave to amend. And if you really want it fleshed out, we could say as follows. It is superior to litigating 2,000 small claims court for the following reasons. A, because no one will do it. Alternatively, because if 100 people did it, the small claims judge would consolidate it anyway and try it as a class action, as a consolidated case, and that is inefficient. Or B, or alternatively, if 2,000 small claims cases were filed, the administrative office of the courts would be screaming bloody murder because they would be overloaded. So there are, in my view, there is ways.
Do you have an example of a published opinion in New Jersey where a court has said that all a plaintiff needs to do to get past the motion to dismiss stage is simply make that type of allegation? It's superior. It's the common issues predominate.
There is no case before this in New Jersey, which has basically said, and again, this is my bedrock problem with the opinion below and the trial court. They never applied Printing Mark. They never did it. So there is no cases. And by the way, there is an exception in class action law to Printing Mark. And we are now requiring you add meat to the bones.
I want to pivot off of questions that Justice Patterson has been asking you. Once we get past numerosity, because that's a factual issue, okay? And we accept that the pleading that there were at least 2,000 people is sufficient, then the issue of predominance and superiority, at least in the context of this case, seems to be pretty much like a legal decision that could be made by this court. Because you heard the discussion that we were having with plaintiff's attorney in terms of, is small claims court really superior to a class action? And the whole predominance issue about whether or not there are common issues of law. In fact, at least in the context of this case, it may not require an elaborate record that would maybe in other cases be established on a summary judgment record. Would you concede that?
Partially, Justice Albin, and I'll tell you why in this case. Let me focus on this case. In this case, the simple allegation that this was a systemic practice that affected thousands of people, that's all we really need for predominance. The pleading alone was sufficient in this case by virtue of the description of the cause of action. And that's in the record. It, you know, the, I think it's PA 1 through PA 15. That's in the record here. So on the predominance issue, we've pled more than enough. It's certainly pled. Now, on the superiority issue, in my view, in this case, it's sufficient to use the legal term. However, if there's any question, it should be remanded or repled. And it can be replaced.
How do you square that, Mr. Nagel, with the many cases by this court, by the appellate division, saying that a court should really carefully look at the, you know, on predominance in particular, which is so often the focus of these cases, but also the other factors, the court should really scrutinize the reality of the case and carefully weigh, and that's Justice Albin's opinion and Lee, as well as many others say this. How do you square that with your argument that all the plaintiff has to do is say, I win on these factors, and you're done?
I'll tell you how, and it's a very easy answer, Justice Patterson, respectfully, because those opinions all are adjudicated with a record. They're all adjudicated on the denial or grant of class certification after discovery, as I've previously talked about. The first phase of all class action litigation is that class cert issue with the discovery. So there is a full record, all of the cases, Lee versus Carter Wallace, local big, all of those cases have the record. Those are not adjudicated on the pleadings, which this case is. So the difference in the arguments is very simple. When the court is obligated to closely scrutinize each of the four issues and make findings with regard to that, whether or not 4:32-1 is satisfied, it has a record. It has discovery and it has experts. On the pleadings, it does not have that.
Right. So in Lee, you're right. It was that's a summary judgment, I believe, Iliadis is as well.
Yes.
So, at this particular stage, when there isn't sufficient information for anyone to determine superiority or predominance, forget about it, then the case should proceed to discovery. I mean, it's just as simple as that.
And thank you, Justice Albin. I could not have said it better. That's exactly the position. So there's one of two ways to skin this cat. Either we accept the pleadings, including legal conclusions or legal assertions as sufficient under printing mark, or we permit a short discovery period, which allows you to supplement the record in order to address the motion dismissed. These motions cannot be granted on bare pleadings, period. I completely agree.
So you're looking for a rule that a rule 462 motion is not, assuming some basic allegations are made, there's some allegation that the requirements are met under Rule 432, that a defendant can't win on the class issue on a motion to dismiss. Is that?
I'm suggesting the answer to that is almost overwhelmingly yes. Again, there may be some intellectual quirk down the road, but as I look at the issue now, the answer is yes. And in this case, the answer is definitely yes.
Mr. Nagel, this may be a better question for Mr. Yedalian, because you're here as a friend of the court. But in this case, don't we have more than simply an assertion that a class action would be superior? Paragraph 31 of the complaint at PA 10 goes through a number of the arguments and reasons that Mr. Yedalian went through with us before. No?
Mr. Chief Justice, exactly correct. And I said earlier, maybe I was inarticulate, that if we look at the complaint, it is well pled. There are factual reasons supporting the legal conclusions in the complaint. It is here in this case. There's no question about it.
Other questions? Mr. Nagel, anything else?
I would just like to end my argument with the very first sentence in Lee versus Carter Wallace that I really believe needs to resonate respectfully with the court. And that is, a class action lawsuit can give a large number of consumers with small claims the power to act collectively in seeking redress against a corporate entity. That was true when written in 2010. It's true today, and it absolutely applies to this case. Where else would it be better acted on than this case? Those words really are binding. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Gives.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The appellate division's decision in this case reflects a pragmatic and legally sound application of the superiority requirement in the extremely narrow context of a putative FACTA class action. The court correctly concluded that given the unique nature of the plaintiff's FACTA claims and the uniquely litigant-friendly structure of the FACTA statute itself, the plaintiffs could not demonstrate that a class action was the superior means of adjudicating alleged technical violations of FACTA that indisputably caused them no real-world harm. The court also correctly concluded that under the unique facts of this case, the superior means to pursue the statutory remedy of up to $1,000 were individual claims brought in small claims court as opposed to a class action. Now, I respectfully submit to you there was no legal error in this. The court clearly identified the appropriate legal standard as set forth in 432:1b3 as developed by this court over the last 3 to 4 decades. And I further respectfully submit, Your Honors, that there was no abuse of discretion in the court's application of that standard to, again, the very unique circumstances presented in this case. And we'd ask that you affirm the principal holding in the appellate division's decision with respect to superiority. Now, at the outset, I'd just like to address the context in which superiority arose in this case. And I submit to you that context is really everything in this case, because in many respects, Your Honors, the FACTA statute is an extraordinary statute. And the statutory remedy set forth in FACTA is extraordinary. And I think that that explains why the appellate division in this case and the trial court before it saw fit to part from what is clearly the general rule that class actions are the appropriate means of taking care or disposing of consumer cases. And they did so because this is not your typical consumer case. And Congress made sure that that was the case. Plaintiff's claims in this case were not, by any definition, negative value claims. And Congress made sure that was the case by structuring FACTA to provide for up to $1,000 in the context of purely procedural errors under FACTA. And I think that's really the game changer here, and it explains why the departure by the appellate division is consistent with this court's jurisprudence. And to understand really what makes it unique, you've got to look at the delta between the statutory remedy of up to $1,000 on this end, that's real money to real people, and the actual harm suffered. And plaintiffs did not even allege that they sustained any actual harm here or no real world harm. It's a purely technical violation. And that's not just a defense lawyer saying that. Congress said that. When it amended FACTA in 2018, there were congressional findings that addressed exactly the kind of claim that plaintiffs asserted in this case. And those were claims where the sales receipt was otherwise compliant with the truncation requirements of FACTA, except for the printing of the expiration date. And you can find these congressional findings, and these are the findings that the O'Shea case that Justice Patterson mentioned, and also the Kumal case and the Paris Baguette case by the Second Circuit. This is the congressional findings that they were looking at. And it's set forth, Your Honors, in the historical and statutory notes in the USCA for section 1681N as in Nancy of FACTA. And congressional finding number 5 says that, I'm sorry, congressional finding number 4 indicates that almost immediately after FACTA went into effect, hundreds of lawsuits were filed alleging that the failure to remove the expiration date was a willful violation of FACTA. The next congressional finding was that none of these lawsuits contained an allegation of harm to any consumer's identity. And the kicker, I submit to you, Your Honors, is congressional finding number 6, where Congress found in amending FACTA that experts in the field agree that proper truncation of the card number by itself, as required by FACTA, regardless of the inclusion of the expiration date, prevents a potential fraudster from perpetrating identity theft or credit card fraud. And I submit to you that that's important because it establishes the delta between the harm suffered here and the potential recovery under FACTA. It's $1,000 and frankly, zero. And that's important because I believe what Congress was attempting to accomplish here was to do what otherwise in another context would have to be done by the class action mechanism. It was leveling the playing field. It was providing an economic incentive for individuals to pursue their FACTA claim. It was opening the courtroom doors to ensure that a person who felt aggrieved by a technical violation of FACTA would pursue his or her rights. And that's what sets this case apart from the typical negative value consumer claim. Clearly, the FACTA claims here are net positive value claims. And that's what changes everything here. And it justifies the departure from the typical rule favoring class actions.
On the issue of superiority, can you explain to us why individual claims are a more efficient, more fair way of proceeding? What does an individual plaintiff have to demonstrate, and let's assume it's without the benefit of counsel in small claims court, in order to show willfulness?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court addressed that, and the Third Circuit addressed that in Long, and it is not a tough case to prove. Willfulness is subject to an objective, unreasonable standard, and discovery is not required. Long addressed that directly. It doesn't matter what PC Richard in this case was thinking or doing internally. What matters is whether or not in the first instance to the court, it was objectively reasonable or unreasonable.
But Congress differentiated between willfulness and negligence. So let's imagine an unrepresented plaintiff goes into small claims court. How on earth is that person without discovery, okay, or legal skill supposed to prove that they were willful as opposed to negligent?
Well, it's up to the plaintiff in the first instance to pursue the course of action. Are they going to pursue a negligence claim or a willfulness claim? But assume you go into small claims with a willfulness claim. It is not a difficult standard, Your Honor, with all due respect.
Tell us. Give the plaintiff a roadmap how to prove it.
Of course.
And if you could answer this question as well.
Yes.
Do you agree you need to come in with more than simply a receipt in order to prove willfulness?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it's very similar to the TCPA claim in local baking, where you went in and you basically showed the violative facts. Here, I think it's an easier case with respect to willfulness.
How can you say that when the TCPA is a strict liability claim and this is a mens rea claim?
TCPA willfulness is relevant to a CPA claim, and they typically are. Most TCPA cases, in my experience, Your Honor, really do turn on willfulness because that's when you get treble damages. And TCPA cases come down to trebling the damages on multiple violations.
It's not a strict liability claim, though, can you?
I'm sorry?
It was sent or it wasn't sent. This is different.
The sales receipt will establish whether or not, first of all, it will establish what retailer issued the receipt. Okay, PC Richard issued this receipt. The sales receipt will indicate, Your Honor, whether or not it complies with the truncation requirements of FACTA. It either does or it doesn't. And whether it was willful doesn't matter what PC Richard was thinking. What matters on the willfulness piece, objectively reasonable or not, is, let's say, Your Honor, hypothetically, this past holiday season, PC Richard issued me a sales receipt that reflected an expiration date on it. At this point in time, I think the judge or the trier of fact could, without further discovery, establish or demonstrate whether or not that was a willful violation of FACTA. Was it reckless or not in 2020?
On the basis of one receipt?
In an individual case, yes. That's all that matters.
How would that be done? If Congress has made a differentiation between willfulness and negligence, okay? Negligence is carelessness, lack of prudence, okay, a mistake. How could a plaintiff waltz into small claims court with a receipt and be able to prove willfulness? I just don't get that.
All I can respond to you, Your Honor, is that it's an objectively unreasonable standard. And, you know, not every small claims court is a slam dunk. But I think in this case, if I went in with a non-compliant sales receipt, I would say it shows PC Richard. It shows my expiration date. And in my earlier hypothetical, they issued in December of 2020.
Okay, so you're just so I'm clear about this.
Yes.
If you are to succeed, and this case goes to a class action, you're conceding that the receipt itself is proof of willfulness.
It can be.
Just so we know.
It can be. And Your Honor, historically, I think the willfulness arguments that you saw in motions to dismiss in FACTA cases were extremely weak.
So you're telling us if Mr. Yedayan goes into court on a class action and waives one receipt, you're going to concede PC Richards.
Not on a class-wide basis, Your Honor. I'm just saying with respect to that particular consumer, I think that's a strong case for willfulness.
Wouldn't you have a defense if, for example, I don't know the facts here, I don't think the facts are known, but if, for example, a third party is responsible for setting up the computer to provide, you know, to provide receipts, wouldn't you have a substantive defense on the question of willfulness since they're not the defendant, you are, your client is?
Well, Your Honor, FACTA speaks of a retailer that generates right. computer.
Right.
So I'm not sure.
I assume that if the case, this or another case were defended on the merits, you'd be saying, and there is in fact a third party contractor that's involved, you would be saying that it's not willful on our part. We told them what to do and they didn't do it properly. I assume there would be a defense on that basis.
Hypothetically, Justice Patterson, that could be the case. But again, we haven't developed the facts in this case to determine one way or another.
Mr. Jones,
so if that's so, then just the fact of the receipt would not be sufficient.
Well, I think practically speaking, if we're talking the individual context in small claims, I mean, you have to look at this, or I submit you should look at this practically, is that if PC Richard gets notice of a small claims court complaint filed for $1,000 in Ocean County on this case, I think in that context, practically speaking, that case is going to resolve, and it's going to resolve quickly. In the class action, you're going to get into more difficult defense issues. But one of the benefits to the individual.
But respectfully, I don't know how you could differentiate between the substantive defense that you would assert in a small claims context and the substantive defense that you would assert in a class action. I understand the stakes are larger and there's a reason to put it on in a class action. But the fact is, if in fact you're saying that it's enough to waive a receipt in small claims, then why isn't it enough to waive a receipt in a class action superior court?
I'm not sure that the fight in the class action context would be over willfulness. I don't think that's the main event. There are going to be other issues that would be litigated, including statute of limitations, which are going to be serious problems for these cases moving forward.
So are you saying that you would concede the first issue and then proceed to the other issues?
I'm saying
that class action, because you said you don't think it would be a problem. So are you saying you would concede that and move on to the other issues?
I think that would not be at all in the top three fights in a class action.
No, that's not what I asked you. I asked you, would you concede that? Not whether it be in the top three fights. If it's a part of a fight with number 57, it's still a fight. You said in small claims it wouldn't be. So my question to you is, in class actions, would you concede that?
I think that PC Richard would be inclined to concede that for class action purposes.
To concede what? I'm sorry.
I think the question was whether or not a receipt showing an expiration date would reflect a willful violation of FACTA.
Isn't that the meat of this? The class action here is based upon statutory damages. The statutory damages are based upon a willful violation. I mean,
yes.
That in essence is the entire class action. Am I mistaken?
No, you're not mistaken on that. But the issue in terms of superiority is which of the means of adjudicating a FACTA violation claim is superior or most fair to the plaintiff or defendant.
I wanted to ask you this question.
Your argument, but hold on, Justice Alden. Are you saying then that simply because a claim can be stated in a statutory penalty case, that alone is a bar to class certification of the action?
No, that argument was made in Carbo. I think it was hinted at in the TGI Friday case. That's not what we're saying. It's the magnitude of the statutory remedy and the nature of the damage. Our argument is more about the delta between those two. We're not saying that as a hard and fast rule, if you have a statutory remedy, you can't have a class action. That's not what we're saying.
So what about this delta makes it superior to bring the action in superior court as opposed to the class action. The class action only has to be, just because there is an alternative doesn't mean that the class action can't be brought.
No, but with respect to the question, Your Honor, of whether a class action is superior to an individual claim, our position is that that delta is key because it indicates whether or not the remedy is sufficiently disproportionate to the harm to provide the economic incentive for an individual to proceed individually against the bad actor.
Why should we look just at the remedy and not at the total cost of having to bring numerous individual actions in superior court in terms of the time, potentially legal expenses, as I think Justice Albin mentioned earlier, but not necessarily, and the dangers of whether or not an unrepresented person will have the wherewithal to muster the proofs necessary to win?
Your Honor, viewed from the perspective of the average Jane or Joe that the class action mechanism is supposed to protect, I don't think it's at all unreasonable to think that someone who actually suffered no harm here by a technical violation would look at the potential recovery of $1,000 or up to $1,000 and determine that it's worth their time and energy to go down, spend $35, file a complaint, and make the best argument they can make.
But isn't the person better off in a class action? Because if the class action doesn't succeed, they're not going to be charged the fee for having filed in superior in special claims, small claims.
Sure.
So there is that risk, right?
There's risk in everything, of course, but the downside to proceeding in a class as opposed to small claims court is that you do stand to recover a substantial amount of money, $750 or $1,000, within weeks, as opposed to waiting for the results of a class action that could proceed for 2 years.
Mr. Gives, have you been to small claims court? Have you ever?
I have not been in small claims court. I'm familiar with the process.
I have.
Okay.
You could be sitting around all day long to have your case heard, and if it's litigated, you may have to come back. Okay, so it's not like you show up at 9 o'clock, your case is heard. There's a courtroom filled with litigants over there. So if you're looking to time and expense and a person giving up a day of work, maybe 2 days of work against what, a recovery between $100 and $1,000, that they may not think that's a really great trade-off. Do you agree?
They may not in the individual case, but again, in terms of superiority, the analysis is whether or not it affords them the opportunity or the incentive to try. There's no guarantee.
Superiority is they can band with other people who wouldn't necessarily have the wherewithal, and as a unified group, go to superior court in order to have their rights vindicated, the rights that Congress has conferred on them. And you may call them technical violations, but Congress considered them violations important enough to put in a piece of legislation.
Your Honor, I just want to be clear on that. I'm not calling them technical violations. That's essentially what Congress found, that there's no harm. They're procedural violations that cause no harm at all.
And I don't know why they passed that law. I for willfulness in providing a remedy between $100 and $1,000, if they didn't expect people to be going into court and putting some people's feet to the fire.
What is your position with respect to the availability of attorney's fees to a prevailing party, in effect, a claim in small claims court in New Jersey?
You can recover attorney's fees in small claims court in New Jersey.
Is it capped at $3,000?
In this case, hypothetically, it would be $1,000 plus whatever your attorney's fees to $3,000. $3,000 would be the cap. But again, the safety valve in special civil is that if you're up against a situation where you think you might exceed the $3,000, you can transfer out.
Can I just clarify one thing? I think you said it, but I just want to make sure. Willfulness is not a state of mind. Willfulness is the printing of the receipt. So in other words, if you demonstrate that PC Richards printed the receipt, you've established willfulness, that is, they willfully printed the receipt, the violated fact.
That's correct. And the later in time you go, the more willful it is.
Just making sure.
Yes, sir.
So what's negligent?
I have never seen a negligent claim in this, in the context. I don't know why you'd pursue one. It's just, it's more difficult to prove. You've got to prove negligence.
It exists though. And from your answer, I don't see how it could possibly find any form. Have you read it out?
I don't disagree with you, Your Honor, but I haven't looked at it closely.
So I'm a bit surprised by the concession that you've made, which is significant on behalf of PC Richard, that would mean anybody walking in with a single receipt prevails under willfulness. Can you tell us when this was corrected, when the expiration dates no longer appeared on the receipts, and what the statute of limitations is?
In reverse order, the statute of limitation under 1681P, it's a 2-year, 5-year scheme. It's 5 years from violation, 2 years from discovery. And our position is that, unlike a fair credit reporting claim, when you got that receipt and it had the expiration date on it, you were on notice of a violation. So the 2 years would control, but it's 2 years from discovery, 5 years from violation. My understanding is that PC Richard corrected this situation through its ID department by late 2018.
You were wise to start with superiority. Is there anything you would like to add on the first question that we spent time on, numerosity? What precision would be required at this stage, and how could it be met prior to discovery?
Your Honor, when we challenged the class allegations in this case, we were mindful of the fact that we were moving prior to discovery, and we felt that numerosity and, to a lesser extent, predominance were fights best left for a later day. We focused on superiority because we don't think there are factual issues there. And again, the standard, as I understand it from this court's decision, is that the substantive factual allegations of a complaint have to be credited as true. And that's exactly what the court did here. There were no receipts attached to the complaint. So we're accepting as true the allegations that there were purchases at Beta PC Richard, receipts were issued, and they violated. So those are the kind of factual issues that are appropriately deemed true. But this court has said on numerous occasions that that deference is not owed to allegations going to whether or not a class action is appropriate. And that's the appellate division did not afford deference to those claims. It engaged in the kind of probing analysis that this court has said repeatedly is required in the superiority context.
I understand how you're prioritizing your arguments. Thank you.
I just want to briefly, Your Honor, of course, address any other questions, but just to address the procedural issue that was raised by amicus. I think it has been made clear by this court, again, that it is appropriate to address superiority at the earliest practical stage in litigation, and that would be inclusive of a motion to dismiss for the reasons discussed. Yes, you have to credit the substantive factual allegations. You do not have to credit allegations going to the appropriate of class action treatment. And that's when you can address those at the very start, pre-discovery of a case.
Other questions, anyone? Thank you, Mr. Gives. Mr. Udalian, did you want to offer a brief rebuttal?
Yes, thanks. I do want to address this issue that defense counsel pointed out concerning the supposed delta between actual damages and the statutory damages that are available. If you look at United Consumer Financial Services Company versus Carbo, that is a perfect example illustrating that this argument does not apply, is not the law in the state of New Jersey. In Carbo, you had a situation where vacuum cleaners were sold using form contracts. And the form contract included a provision allowing for the ability to impose a $20 return check fee. And there were the opinion states that there were no complaints about the vacuum cleaner itself. The opinion states that there's no evidence that anybody was charged that $20 fee, but it was a statutory violation. And at page 306 of the opinion, the court said, quote, "It is not material that an unauthorized fee or a return check was neither assessed against nor collected from a member of the class," end quote. And the remedies there were statutory damages and attorney's fees. So this idea that there somehow this delta controls, Carbo was a case where there were zero damages, but the court held that statutory damages are available as well as attorney's fees. and with respect and did address this in the context of superiority itself. Page 308 of the opinion, the court said, UCFSC and the distributors argue that whereas here the common, typical, and predominant claim of the class members is a statutory violation for which a statutory civil penalty will be awarded, a class action is not superior to individual private actions, end quote. That superiority argument is the same argument that PC Richard makes here, and that argument was rejected in the Carbo case despite the fact that there was no harm. So this Delta argument isn't even the law in the state of New Jersey. With respect to the TCPA and willfulness.
Can I just ask you a question about Carbo?
Sure.
In Carbo, wasn't the civil penalty capped at $100?
It was. It was
$100. I thought the superiority argument here was $1,000 potential recovery as a civil penalty is a heck of a lot more than $100, for example.
Well, it's a range of $100 to $1,000.
I understand.
So the range is higher, yes. But the point is that I understood the defense argument, the claim that where you have zero in actual damages, the fact that you have any statutory damage remedy available is a windfall somehow to the people that are harmed by the violation. And therefore, in such instances, you can never satisfy superiority given the fact that actual harm is zero. And so that's the reason I point out the Carbo opinion. And also, if we're gonna get into these things, these types of fine lines, what if you have a statute that says $101 versus $100 or $500, like the TCPA or $900? How does a trial court parse those differences and who gets to draw the line? And respectfully, that is not the analysis. The analysis, as outlined in the rule, is you look to, are there alternative remedies and are the venues, and are those alternative venues superior? And I'm not gonna rehash the different factors that a court looks at. Mr. Nagel did that, and I did that previously, but that is respectfully the analysis. And that's why this argument that the defense has raised simply doesn't apply, and Carbo is a perfect example of that. With respect to the TCPA, I agree that the TCPA is a strict liability statute. You get $500 simply by showing the receipt. It's interesting, and I'm glad to hear PC Richard today concede that all you need to do is show a receipt that violates FACTA in order to establish willfulness. And we'll stick with that concession. However, I want to state that previously in the New York case, when it came to the issue of willfulness, PC Richards filed a motion to dismiss, arguing that their conduct can't be a willful violation. And so, they're essentially talking out of both sides of their mouth, but I do appreciate that they can have a change of heart and consider the situation and the facts, and apparently they have, and they now concede that willfulness has been established in this case, so we'll go with that. But I do want to point out that before the New York court, they did take a different approach, and it wasn't just simply showing up with a receipt. With respect to the 2008 Congress amendment concerning FACTA, the Ninth Circuit, in its Bateman opinion, discussed this. The Ninth Circuit said that in 2008, when they amended the FACTA statute, Congress knew that class actions concerning FACTA were being filed. And the Bateman opinion, the Ninth Circuit said that provided Congress with a prime opportunity to either limit class actions or do away entirely with the statutory remedy of $100 to $1,000 for expiration date violations. And as the Ninth Circuit pointed out, Congress neither barred class actions nor did it bar the statutory remedies for an expiration date violation. And that's the reason why we're here today, because Congress did no such thing, and a FACTA claim can be stated with respect to an expiration date violation. This idea that willfulness, counsel cited to the Long opinion out of the Third Circuit concerning willfulness, that was a completely different situation. In Long, the facts were If you have a partial printing of the expiration date, meaning you print either the month or the year, but not both the month and the year, is that a violation of the expiration date provision? Long held that that is a violation, but because it was an issue that previously wasn't decided, willfulness was an object in that case, but turned on an objective interpretation of the statute. In other words, the defendant there claimed that they misunderstood the statute. In this case, PC Richards is not claiming that they misunderstood the statute. So this case does not turn on the interpretation of the statute. This case turns on whether its conduct of printing an admitted violation of the expiration date provision was willful. And as I said before, in the typical FACTA case, showing that a violation is willful or not requires discovery to show what type of conduct, how often it was repeated, whether they had checks and safeguards against allowing a situation like this to happen. And so that's what discovery turns on. But again, we will take PC Richards' concession today that printing a receipt with the expiration date included on its own is a willful violation of FACTA.
Thank you, Councilor. We'll take the matter under advisement.